WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. My cat hates going to the vet, but I think she'd like Dr. Nick Trout if she could read his new memoir, Tell Me Where It Hurts, or listen to the interview we'll feature with him on today's Fresh Air. He's an animal surgeon who treats cats and dogs. He'll talk about surgical interventions once reserved for humans, and he'll describe some of his more unusual cases, like a dog with both male and female anatomical characteristics, and a cat that was 40 pounds. Even if all that didn't impress my cat, she'd like hearing Dr. Trout's reflections on how important animals have become in the lives of people. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by Adam Green, who co-wrote the song Anyone Else But You in the film Juno. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Animal surgeon Nick Trout has noticed that many pet owners feel more like pet parents. The people who bring their animals to him want him to know how much they love their pets. He loves animals, although the cats and dogs he treats might not return the sentiment during his examinations. We're going to talk about some of his more unusual cases and how the whole field of veterinary medicine has changed in the past few decades with interventions that were once reserved for people. Dr. Trout is a staff surgeon at the Angel Animal Medical Center in Boston, which is part of the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. He's also the author of the memoir, Tell Me Where It Hurts. Dr. Trout, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, the name of your book is Tell Me Where It Hurts, and of course that's a great title because you can't ask your patients to tell you anything. I mean, you can ask them, but they can't speak. Of course, you can talk to the people who live with the animals, but how else do you compensate in trying to diagnose a cat or a dog?
Well, I think one of the appeals of veterinary medicine is it's a very hands-on experience. We are obviously going to, for want of a better word, interrogate the pet parent in an attempt to try to get the information, the subtle changes, the nuances that really they see far better than us in their daily lives, the things that have triggered them to want to make a veterinary visit. And then I think we move on to an experience in which we are trying to hunt for clinical signs. Unlike our human counterparts, the MDs, we don't get the gift of that unambiguous communication, the opportunity to describe a little twitch or a pain or a very subtle problem. And so I think we have to be more interactive with our animal. And sometimes that's an easy thing to do. And then certain patients will make that a little bit more challenging. We don't have that luxury of the open-minded and just say, the deep breaths only, please.
So what are some of the things you do to diagnose a pet to compensate for the fact that you can't talk with the animal?
Well, I think there are obviously instances in which the problem is so blatantly obvious it sort of hits us upside the head. But if not, then we're going to move on to, you know, potentially x-rays, radiographs, CTs, MRIs, blood work, urinalysis, just a whole ultrasound, a whole wealth of new technologies that we as people take for granted and that have now permeated veterinary medicine to become sort of the normal standard of healthcare for our animals.
I want you to tell us about one of your more challenging cases. And this is a case, I would describe this dog as almost a hermaphrodite. It's a male dog that had become feminized. Why don't you describe what it had?
So yeah, this wasn't an easy story to convey and get across, but I tried my best to basically describe a boxer dog who on the outside appeared to be male. This dog only had one descended testicle, and the remaining testicle inside had succumbed to a tumor that was secreting feminine hormones. And those feminine hormones were making this male dog become somewhat female in nature. This dog would stand to be mounted by other dogs, had somewhat pendulous breasts, and had this real sort of hormonal turmoil going on inside of him. The other problem was, unbeknownst to both me and the owner, that he had a remnant of an embryonic uterus that should have disappeared during his development as a puppy, and yet had persisted. And so this increase in female hormones had sort of turned on a female reproductive organ within his body. And as a result, he had developed what's called a pyometra, which is not an uncommon infection of this male dog's uterus. And so this gave me this very unique once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to end up actually neutering and spaying one and the same dog.
That's just really bizarre.
It was quite bizarre. And, you know, occasionally these cases do get reported in the veterinary literature. What is more entertaining is how you explain this to a somewhat chauvinistic owner.
And how did you?
Well, I like to think that the feminine side of his male dog brought out the feminine side in him.
How so?
Well, because, you know, he He did find it difficult. He was just insistent that this was a male dog and that this couldn't be happening, this hormonally induced ability to be attractive to the other male dog in the dog park. And so what I ensured at the end of the day was that he should understand that the male side of this dog actually shines through and was the dominant party, and he seemed to be comfortable with that.
You know, one of the supermarket tabloids seems to specialize in bizarre animal stories. I wouldn't have been surprised if they picked up on this one. But, you know, they just have a lot of stories about, like, the biggest cat in the world or half cat, half dog.
Right.
You know, and they kind of combine the photos together, so it's half cat and half dog. Do you ever run into that where a tabloid picks up on one of the more unusual medical stories?
You've got me worried now. I'm wondering if I'm going to be inundated with phone calls. But, I mean, I think the closest I come to it was the very real story of a 40-pound cat that, you know, I remember someone showing me a picture of this animal that had come in and just being both shocked and appalled by its size. And it led me into an opportunity really to discuss this epidemic that animals face in our society today, which is not only for us but also our pets, you know, obesity and overweight.
What did this 40-pound cat look like? That's a lot.
This, I mean, just like carrying a beanbag that you would sit in. I mean, this is just a ridiculous amount of fur and flesh, and almost to a point of hardly being able to see where the limbs and head were. A 40-pound bag of potatoes or whatever is a significant weight to be carrying, let alone to be carrying around with you when your little skeleton is so small and relatively fragile to that body mass.
What kind of advice do you typically give to a person about their overweight pet and how to get their pet to lose weight?
Well, I think the first thing is an acceptance that there is a weight problem. You know, I think some owners are shocked and appalled when I say, I think your pet could stand to lose some pounds. And I always encourage owners to put a piece of paper on the refrigerator with a magnet to write down the date, to actually put down the accurate body weight, and to first of all do their best efforts of not giving the treats and see if that makes a difference. And if it does, and they actually see objectively on a week-by-week basis that the weight is falling off, then fabulous. And if not, then I think they need to maybe seek nutritional or veterinary advice, but also should be an increase in activity, an increase in exercise.
Well, what are the medical problems involved with being overweight, you know, with cats and dogs? I mean, your concern isn't that they look too fat.
Right.
You're concerned medically. So what's the problem?
Yes. Well, I mean, me personally, you know, doing surgery, the biggest thing I see is significant risk of arthritis and worsening of arthritis. There was a study some years ago that showed something like an 11 to 18% weight loss of overweight pets could produce a statistically significant improvement in lameness. And to actually achieve statistical significance is a big deal. And so I've had many cases over the years, dogs that are overweight, the owner comes in, we talk about a more conservative approach to their dog's hip problem, say, a problem that they originally came in for an expensive hip replacement surgery. We get the weight off over a couple of months, and I get phone calls saying, I don't need to do that hip replacement surgery. My dog is doing great. I'm very pleased. Losing that weight made all the difference. And so that's one way in which I feel the big impact of improving animals' body weight.
So carrying around all that extra weight affects the hips and the legs?
Well, it's just, you know, it's intuitive. You know, the more we load these joints, the more these joints are going to have to adapt. And sadly, for the most part, that means that building arthritic bone and trying to reduce range of motion. And, you know, we see it in these animals. You know, the more you carry, the less you exercise, the less you move your joints around and lubricate those joints. And it's like this vortex that we're sort of spiraling down and into.
My guest is animal surgeon Nick Trout, author of the new memoir, Tell Me Where It Hurts. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is animal surgeon Nick Trout, author of the memoir, Tell Me Where It Hurts. You must see that a lot where people are just like so close
Absolutely.
To their animal and are therefore so unsure about what to do because they don't want the animal to die. You know, in a situation like this, do you do the surgery? Do you not do the surgery? Will it work? Will the animal die? What are some of the like kinds of really emotional conversations you end up getting into with pet owners when their animals are in jeopardy?
It's really varies dependent on the nature of the problem. But I think the first thing I try to do is to sort of step back from being sucked into the emotion of the relationship, because my first responsibility is to try to tell the owner what the problem is and what options we have to deal with it. I'm just trying to give them their information, because there's obviously so much from their side of the examination table that I don't know, you know, the depth of this relationship, the importance of the animal in their life, their previous experiences with loss, their own health issues, their thoughts on natural death versus euthanasia, and, you know, last but not least, their ability to pay for whatever care would be required. And so I think, first of all, I try to say, this is what's there for us. These are the potential medical scenarios that we might have. And then invariably, in these difficult situations, so many times people will say to me, so what would you do if this were your animal? And then I have that sort of chance to be more subjective, to try to put my spin on it, to sort of dig up from my personal experiences with animals and my own sort of bias on what I think is right to put an animal through and what we may expect on the other end. I think one of the things we need to convey is the fact that whatever we're putting our animal through with some of these difficult decisions and these potentially life-threatening problems, that animal really doesn't have an ability to appreciate that I'm going to have to go through something negative, because I have that notion of extended life. I have an understanding that this is all for the good for me, because there's the other end of the equation at which life will be improved for me. You know, they're living in the here and now. And so that responsibility of what decision we make very much falls with us as pet owners. And I think we need to look at that carefully and say, whatever we put our animal through, are we going to get, is it reasonable what we're going to ask? And also, on the other end of this, are we going to see enough upside and benefits to make it worthwhile?
This must be one of the more frustrating parts of being a vet. You know, again, you can't talk to the animal and you can't explain to the animal that this is going to help the animal in the long run.
But I think there is that wonderful silent communication, you know, when we are working with these animals, this sense of their understanding that we are doing and trying to do the right thing by them, if only in the fact that so many of them sort of accept it, they appreciate what we're doing, and it's so easy to convey in the silence between us that we mean well and we want to do right by them.
I'll tell you, not my cat. My cat is so terrified of going to the doctor. And when we put her in the carrier and then take her into the doctor's office, she starts howling like a wolf. It sounds like the beginning of a vampire movie. It is so pathetic to hear her. And then one doctor actually refused to treat her because she'd just gotten so wild. It's like she was possessed. One doctor put her like in a little pussycat straitjacket so he could kind of get to her without being, fought by
sure.
her. So I think she doesn't feel that special calming presence.
Well, I think
that you're
at
describing.
Least from our side of the table, we're trying to convey that. whether it's reciprocated or not is another matter.
Well, what do you do in a situation like that when you're facing a cat that's just terrified?
Well, it happens, and I think if you can achieve what you are trying to do in order to, you know, find out what's wrong with that animal, and you can do it somehow around physical restraint, then that's what we would do. But there are instances when you just have to say, I'm going to cause your animal far more distress battling away here than if we could just give a little chemical restraint and be able to get to the problem more quickly and without distressing the animal in the process.
Yeah, I think some sedation wouldn't have been a bad idea in this.
Well,
instance.
It probably makes you feel better as well that, you know, at least they're relaxing into the experience because, I mean, it does become silly after a while because they're very talented with their teeth and claws and for a good reason. That little fight and flight mechanism from way back in evolution is still happy to kick in.
Yeah. Veterinary medicine has changed so much in the past few years. I remember the first time I heard that a pet was going to get chemo for cancer, and I thought, wow, that sounds so extreme. And now it's just kind of standard, I think.
Right.
For a lot of animals, if you get cancer, you get the treatment. And, you know, animals get MRIs now, and therefore veterinary expenses have just skyrocketed, and it's very difficult for pet owners to keep up with those expenses, and they sometimes have to make very difficult decisions about how much they're capable of spending to keep their animal alive.
Sure.
What are some of the interventions that you use now that would have been unheard of 10 or 20 years ago?
Well, as you rightly point out, I mean, MRI is sort of the standard of care now for all these dogs that come in with potential brain problems, spinal problems, CAT scans, ultrasound, bone scans, and, you know, chemotherapy, radiation therapy. We will do, you know, hip replacements, arthroscopy, endoscopy, thoracoscopy, brain surgery, spinal surgery. If you're doing it on a person, you're pretty much doing it for an animal. At least you have the opportunity to. Renal transplants, open heart surgery, all of these things are becoming increasingly the norm when it comes to our pets, because I think it just comes down to the fact that not only are these options available to us, but also, you know, the shift in the importance of the animal in our lives. You know, pets are family. This is my child is the standard comment I get from the vast majority of my clients. And if this is my child, then I want the kind of care that I would expect from my child. And sadly, in the new millennium of veterinary care, we are becoming not limited by medical advances or surgical advances, but really the ability to pay for those.
One thing that you're really opposed to is cosmetic surgery for animals, unless it's medically required. What are some of the typical cosmetic surgeries being done now that you think should not be done?
Well, I like to think this goes back to my British sensibilities as a member of the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons being educated in England. The Royal College does not approve of any kind of cosmetic surgery like ear cropping or tail docking. And so the UK is full of floppy-eared Dobermans and Great Danes and Rottweilers with long sweeping tails. And so, if the blame lies anywhere, it lies with my upbringing and education, and also now that I work at Angel, which is part of the MSPCA, the Massachusetts Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, in which we perform no tail docking or ear cropping or declawing of cats, and that's fine by me. I think. There's one of the things I mentioned, are these things called neuticles, these testicular implants that can be inserted into dogs at the time of neutering and castration.
What's the purpose of that?
The purpose, as far as, again, this is my personal opinion, is entirely cosmetic. It is to give them an outline, an anatomical outline that looks like nothing had happened, that they retain that outward appearance of being male. It serves no medical or hormonal benefit. These are inert inserts that just go into the vacated scrotum. They are purely cosmetic, and I have a problem with that.
Dr. Nick Trout will be back in the second half of the show. His new memoir about his work as an animal surgeon is called Tell Me Where It Hurts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Birmingham 35 Miles, about one man's struggle with love, family ties, and survival in the near future, by James Brazil. From the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, making tough calls about older animals, when to medically treat them, when to put them to sleep. We continue our conversation with animal surgeon Nick Trout. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by singer-songwriter Adam Green. He co-wrote one of the songs in the film Juno. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Nick Trout. He's a veterinary surgeon who has written a new memoir called Tell Me Where It Hurts. He treats cats and dogs at the Angel Animal Medical Center in Boston, which is part of the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Now that there are so many more interventions that you can use to deal with pet problems ranging from spinal issues to cancer, have the questions changed and the ethics changed surrounding when to put a pet down, when to put a pet to sleep?
Yes, I think that, you know, one of the things that we fear is that because we can take an animal longer into their life, because we have these options, should we be doing this? Who are we doing it for? Are we doing it for ourselves more than we are for the animal? And I think it's a very difficult issue. From time to time, we'll see cases whereby an owner just refuses to put an animal to sleep, and I know I've had situations in my career where I've done surgeries removing tumors only to find that they've grown back 2 weeks later at the time of suture removal, saying, you know, I just didn't achieve anything here. What is the upside? And I think those are difficult issues. But again, you know, veterinary medicine is a service industry. We are working with animals, but for people. And I have to step back and somewhat respect their decisions, as long as, of course, the overall welfare of the animal is not being jeopardized. And sometimes that is a tough call.
Can you give us another example of a tough call that you helped a person make?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember an old poodle coming in to see me many years ago. Something like a 15-year-old dog, which is a joke about 15 being the new 11 in dog years. But I think, you know, 15 is a fabulous age for a dog. I mean, if you got a dog to 15, that's a great life. And this dog had malignant melanoma, which is, you know, should raise hackles in the same way as that label does in URI. You know, that's a serious cancerous tumor with a pretty poor prognosis despite treatment. And the problem with this dog was it had an orthopedic problem, a knee injury. And at the time, the dog was doing great on its chemotherapy. All the blood parameters were great. The owner was thrilled with the way the dog was doing and sort of said to me, look, you know, my problem is my dog's knee. And despite me sort of lecturing her with all these sad and negative statistics, she said, I feel like I want to go ahead. And, you know, the bottom line is, fortunately, as in people, age is not a disease. It's not going to say, you know, your dog is 15, therefore we should stop at this point. And I did the surgery. And to our mutual delight, the dog lived another 2 years of wonderful quality life, able to run around and not being limited by a gimpy knee. And so it's like this slap upside the head saying, you know, even when you least expect it, even when you think, you know, or question, am I doing the right thing? There will always be those cases out there that just sort of scream back at you, look, I made it. Why be so negative for another animal in the future? And so it does make some of these difficult cases tough calls.
In the human world, if somebody's sick and in a great deal of pain and they want to end their life, that's not accepted right now. A lot of people think it should be accepted, but it's not. In the animal world, it's always been more accepted to put down an animal, whether it's a large animal or a small one, if they're in a great deal of pain and there's no hope for that to improve. Do you think the standard has changed at all with animals?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, that euthanasia is still a very important part of what we do. You know, people have religious, spiritual, moral issues with euthanasia, and that's, you know, that's obviously a very personal decision on their part. And, you know, some of it comes down to the fact that for veterinarians, we still have that oath. And there's still that thought of, you know, first do no harm. And if that harm is actually putting to an animal to sleep, you know, are we going against that oath? But I think the way I look at it and what I mention in the book is the fact that, you know, I think all of us aspire to that death in which we died peacefully in our sleep. And, you know, that holds some appeal. And that, you know, veterinarians have this responsibility, or at least this option, to cause a loss of consciousness, to alleviate pain without the application of pain, that we can bring to bear a dignified and graceful end to an animal's life. But it is a very difficult and emotive issue.
What do you tell people about what to expect if they're watching the lethal injection?
I think I've learnt the hard way to very much prepare them, because a whole variety of things can happen. I've come to very much prefer having a catheter, plastic tubing into a vein so that we can deliver the injection without the act of a needle when they witness the event. I've told them that dogs may take a deep breath, a sort of final sigh. They may pant. They may paddle. They may lose control of bodily functions. I do warn them that for the most part, dogs and cats leave this world with their eyes open, that that sort of Hollywood ending of laying on of hands and that they're closing their eyes sometimes doesn't happen. And I've learned, you know, make sure you tell them that this is, you know, you're just flushing the catheter with a saline solution, because you give them the injection, they look at you surprised that the animal is still alive. I've also warned them it's very quick, it's very painless. Some people are so surprised that it happens so gracefully and so quickly. You know, they really expected something more. And you know, there's some solace to be taken in it actually being a sort of quiet and peaceful event.
Do you usually recommend that the owner be in the room with their animal in those final moments?
Yes, absolutely. I think I give it to them as an option, and the vast majority of people will take that. They want to be there. They want to share that final exchange in the eyes between them and their animal as they slip away. And it's such a tough moment. But when you know, if you put it into the context of a horribly debilitating and life-threatening disease, how many times have we seen loved ones slip away slowly and painfully and be, you know, just a husk of their former self? You know, it's, I talk in the book about my recollections of my own first dog and how I felt a party to keeping an animal alive too long. And in doing so, the guilt of that sort of weighed on me and filled my memories more than all the good times for the vast majority of the animal's life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Nick Trout. He's a veterinarian who's written a new book, which is called Tell Me Where It Hurts. And he's a surgeon at the Angel Animal Medical Center near Boston. Let's take a short break here, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Nick Trout. He's a veterinarian who has written a new book called Tell Me Where It Hurts, and he's a staff surgeon at the Angel Animal Medical Center near Boston. On the dust jacket of your book, Tell Me Where It Hurts, there's a photo of you with your two dogs, and one of them is a big Labrador who's sitting next to you, and he looks really large. And then there's a little, was it a Jack Russell?
Correct. Yes.
Who's sitting on your lap. And, you know, he's really small, particularly compared to the big lab. Did you intentionally get a really large and a really small dog?
That's my youngest daughter's doing. When Emily said she wanted a dog, what am I going to do? We got the terrier initially. Sophie is 11 years old. And you know, incredible dogs, very smart dogs. You know, she's got that sort of Red Bull running through her veins. And she actually now at 11 years old has slowed down just slightly. And so I like to think that that gives me an opportunity to empathize with the terrier owners. And then I, of course, have the Labrador, which is another pick by my daughter. And this gives me the orally fixated happy-go-lucky retriever and gives me a chance to empathize with the retriever owners. We've, for many years, had cats, but my daughter is allergic to cats, and so sadly we don't have any cats in our life right now, but I'm sure that will change.
What do you miss most about not having cats in your life?
It's that independent quality for me. It's that, you know, you live by my standards. I'm going to do what I want to. I'll let you in when I want you to come into my life. We've had some fabulous cats. One particular cat called Reginald was just such a character, and did live with these two dogs and completely dominated them. He was the boss, and you know, I really miss that aspect of having a feline in my life.
What about in your house now? Who's the dominant dog? Is it the big lab little Jack Russell?
The terrier is completely in control. She just rules the roost, and the goofy Labrador seems quite content to live on her terms. So. Yeah, it's a nice mix, actually. I was very surprised that it worked out as well as it did.
Let me read something you write in your acknowledgments at the end of your book. You write about your wife: like so many mothers of children with chronic disease, she has quietly sacrificed her life for the greater good of our family. What is the disease that your daughter has?
My daughter has cystic fibrosis, which is the number one genetic killer of children and young people in this country. And she was diagnosed at about 2.5 years of age. And, you know, there was no way not to pay homage to my wife in this acknowledgement, because, you know, she has sacrificed a lot for our daughter, for our daughter's care. And, you know, that it's funny, the when you first get this diagnosis, I'm sure so many parents of children with chronic disease, there's all the anger and frustration. And I think at that time, I did question, you know, I'm here treating pets, yet this child with my own, you know, sharing some of my genes and DNA is so sick. Should I be reconsidering what I'm doing? Should I be thinking about becoming a human doctor, a research scientist, trying to find a cure? And all that anger sort of builds up in you. And then, you know, as the time goes by, you start to realize that you are so blessed and so lucky to have this child in your life, and she's such a great kid. And you start to accept your situation and the good fortune you have despite what she goes through. And I think some of that has been beneficial to me in my dealings with pet parents, because I see in them the same kind of fear and concern when they're faced with a similar crisis for someone who is a child to them, who they love just as much as I do my daughter.
It must be hard for you to be a doctor who can cure so many animals' problems, but your daughter has a condition that can't be cured.
Yeah, but I'm an optimist. The glass is always half full for me, and I hope that is reflected in the way I practice veterinary medicine. Again, cystic fibrosis is a disease that is on the cutting edge of medical technology. People want to cure this disease. They're working very hard with gene therapy. And it is on the cusp. And there are so many other diseases out there that are so far away from a cure. And, you know, I just am, again, so fortunate that I have a daughter with a problem that is sort of in the medical limelight and is being addressed. And so I have to believe that a cure is around the corner, and I just have to hang in there. She has to hang in there, and I'll do everything in my power to make that happen. I'm a very fortunate person.
Is she the daughter that chose the two dogs?
Yes, of course. To be honest, with regard to Meg, the Labrador, she and I were in the critical care unit at Boston's Children's Hospital. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. And she said to me, and she must have been about 8 or 9 at the time, and she said to me, "Daddy, are you going to get me that yellow Labrador I want? What are you going to say? she's got you completely cornered. So I said yes. She was quick to remind me when she came out of hospital, and so it happened.
Let me ask you, you know, you mentioned that you know that some of the pet owners who bring their pets to you love their animals as much as a parent loves a child. That will sound offensive to some people. Some people think that, you know, animals can't possibly have the weight or be worthy of the same depth of feeling that a child can be.
I would have to disagree. I mean, you know, obviously everybody's welcome to their own opinion, but I mean, I've seen it with my own eyes. You know, there can be no question in my mind that the depth of love and affection for the animals in some people's lives is no less than I've seen with people with children. You know, I talk in the book about one section in which I referred to the chapter as Dangerous Liaisons, because some people, you know, get so invested in their animals. I mean, one gentleman who legally changed his middle name to that of his dog because he just felt that at the end of his life, he wanted his dog to be buried with him, the dog's ashes to be buried with him, and that for people to look at his tombstone and say, you know, that's how much that dog meant to me. I mean, that's intense. That's so deeply rooted. And, you know, whether a woman who's so obsessed with the dog in her life, she'll happily endure injections on a twice weekly basis and live with an inhaler because she's horribly allergic to the animal, but it still sleeps in the same bed, shares a pillow. I mean, this is deeply rooted. And I think the other thing to take away is the fact that when these animals that we bring into our lives, we consider them to be our children. You know, the natural order of things is such that we should not bury the children in our lives. You know, they should outlive us. And yet we embrace them with all that love and commitment that, full well knowing that probably in our lifetime, we're going to have to let them go and live without them again. And that's what's so hard, that you love a creature so much and yet you're sort of living with this anticipatory grief. One of my friends just got a new Shih Tzu puppy, and, you know, she is so in love with this animal. She's saying to me already, I don't know how I'm going to cope with losing this animal. I mean, something 15, 16, 17 years in the future, and yet there's already that sort of niggling fear that this is going to have to come to an end.
Well, Dr. Nick Trout, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Nick Trout is a veterinary surgeon at the Angel Animal Medical Center in Boston. It's part of the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by Adam Green. He co-wrote one of the songs in the film Juno. This is Fresh Air. One of the high points of the movie Juno is a duet sung by its stars Ellen Page and Michael Cera. That song, Anyone Else But You, was written by Adam Green and Kimya Dawson, co-founders of the New York folk music group The Moldy Peaches. Adam Green has recorded a number of solo albums, and his new one is called Sixes and Sevens. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Home life is so unnerving. I'd like to be lost in a crowd. My home life is disconcerting. I've got to keep my money down. Home life, home life. Anyways, there'll soon be little kids just like my old life.
The 26-year-old singer-songwriter Adam Green sings in a pleasantly deep voice. What he sings about over the course of Sixes and Sevens' 20 songs is open to a lot of interpretation. That warm voice and his often lovely melodies are frequently at odds with lyrics filled with surreal or disjointed or intentionally banal images. Take this excellently odd tune about seduction and its aftermath, set to a Memphis soul rhythm.
Mismatching underwear, I'm gonna take you there to see my body. Tweet, tweetie. No one ever gets a break. I'm not about to make you enjoy them. Tweet, tweetie. I want you to hear my voice. I want you to make me laugh. Oh, ballistic on the world.
That song is called Tweet, tweetie. And indeed, it is a bit twee. That is both pretty and precious, cleverly knowing without being completely willing to let you in on what he's being clever about. For an extreme example of this, listen to this song, which Green has referred to as an anti-folk take on the blues.
This is how we go to school and know how to butter your bread. Travel to 80 miles high. Get shot down like a duck. And show me how to dig my hole. Show me how to get down slow. Butter your roll just like Nat King Cole.
Yes, stick it to him.
Elsewhere, this arty, poker-faced experimentalist, and I intend all those descriptions as compliments, comes close to the folk music with which we're most familiar. You know, the 60s kind, with a little protesty message. That's one way to hear this song called Getting Led, led as in being led by the nose, about being drawn into foreign engagements against one's will. And, oh yes, it's sung from the point of view of America itself, talking to us, justifying itself.
I was a nation bound to my station. Getting led, getting led, getting led. You saw beyond me, pounding down on me. Getting led, getting led, getting led. A man fills his quotient. He changed his notions. Now you see a glimpse of liberty. But fame could be garish. It ends his marriage to all that you could want for him to be.
The music Green makes with the Moldy Peaches has aligned him with the so-called anti-folk or indie folk movements centered around New York City. But more often on this solo album, Green breaks with the Moldy Peaches folk or anti-folk and works in other genres with great skill and fluidness. His resonant voice is perfectly suited, for example, for the pop soul music of Morning After Midnight, backed by a gospel chorus.
Hey, things won't be strange any day now. They change every day. Hey, things won't be bad all the time now. Stay bad all the time. But hey now, little lady, this is a tragical
sign, it's a sign. Morning after midnight, things don't ever go right. Morning after midnight, hey, bye bye. Not so sad to wake up, but I took the beta. Morning after midnight, what's going on?
Hepatitis and Easy Pass, Strangulation, Robin Hood and Stagger Lee all make appearances over the course of this album, and Adam Green fractures narratives without abandoning a consistent tone. He's a skeptical romantic, a crooning doubter, a wise guy who knows that irony is no substitute for well-crafted sincerity, or at least a seductively urgent tone that tries to pass itself off as sincerity.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Sixes and Sevens by Adam Green. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
I used to be friends with rich kids, but all they talked about was me. 'Cause I was looking for a date on the corner, like a foghorn shouting in the breeze. And I'll bake on a cloud, I'll spare.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Skoll.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, on Good Friday, we hear about the history of crucifixion as a form of execution. We talk with John Dominic Crossan, one of the leading scholars of the historical Jesus, and author of the books The Birth of Christianity and Who Killed Jesus. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.